The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha Christie, Chapter 10. I was violently excited. I was sure that I'd hit on the right trail at last. One thing was clear. I must not move out of the cabin. The asafoetida had got to be born. I examined my facts again. Tomorrow was the 22nd, and at 1 a.m. or 1 p.m., something would happen. I plumped for 1 a.m. It was now 7 o'clock. In 6 hours, I should know. I don't know how I got through the evening. I retired to my cabin fairly early. I had told the stewardess that I had a cold in the head and didn't mind smells. She still seemed distressed, but I was firm. The evening seemed interminable. I duly retired to bed, but in view of emergencies, I swathed myself in a thick flannel dressing gown and encased my feet in slippers. Thus attired, I felt that I could spring up and take an active part in anything that happened. What did I expect to happen? I hardly knew. Vague fancies, most of them wildly improbable, flitted through my brain. But one thing I was firmly convinced of: at 1 o'clock, something would happen. At various times, I heard my fellow passengers coming to bed. Fragments of conversation, laughing good nights, floated in through the open transom. Then, silence. Most of the lights went out. There was still one in the passage outside, and there was therefore a certain amount of light in my cabin. I heard 8 bells go. The hour that followed seemed the longest I had ever known. I consulted my watch surreptitiously to be sure I had not overshot the time. If my deductions were wrong, if nothing happened at 1 o'clock, I should have made a fool of myself and spent all the money I had in the world on a mare's nest. My heart beat painfully. 2 bells went overhead. 1 o'clock. And nothing. Wait, what was that? I heard the quick light patter of feet running along the passage. Then, with the suddenness of a bombshell, my cabin door burst open and a man almost fell inside. "Save me," he said hoarsely. "They're after me." It was not a moment for argument or explanation. I could hear footsteps outside. I had about 40 seconds in which to act. I had sprung to my feet and was standing facing the stranger in the middle of the cabin. A cabin does not abound in hiding places for a 6-foot man. With one arm, I pulled out my cabin trunk. He slipped down behind it under the bunk. I raised the lid. At the same time, with the other hand, I pulled down the wash basin. A deft movement, and my hair was screwed into a tiny knot on the top of my head. From the point of view of appearance, it was inartistic. From another standpoint, it was supremely artistic. A lady, with her hair screwed into an unbecoming knob, and in the act of removing a piece of soap from her trunk, with which apparently to wash her neck, could hardly be suspected of harboring a fugitive. There was a knock at the door, and without waiting for me to say, "Come in," it was pushed open. I don't know what I expected to see. I think I had vague ideas of Mr. Paget brandishing a revolver, or my missionary friend with a sandbag, or some other lethal weapon. But certainly I didn't expect to see a night stewardess with an inquiring face and looking the essence of respectability. "I beg your pardon, miss, I thought you called out." "No," I said, "I didn't. I'm sorry for disturbing you." "That's all right," I said. "I couldn't sleep. I thought a wash would do me good. It sounded rather as though it were a thing I never had as a general rule." "I'm so sorry, miss," said the stewardess again. "But there's a gentleman about who's rather drunk, and we're afraid he might get into one of the ladies' cabins and frighten them." "How dreadful," I said, looking alarmed. "He won't come in here, will he?" "Oh, I don't think so, miss. Ring the bell if he does. Good night." "Good night." I opened the door and peeped down the corridor. Except for the retreating form of the stewardess, there was nobody in sight. Drunk. So that was the explanation of it. My histrionic talents had been wasted. I pulled the cabin trunk out a little farther and said, "Come out at once, please," in an acid voice. There was no answer. I peered under the bunk. My visitor lay immovable. He seemed to be asleep. I tugged at his shoulder. He didn't move. Dead drunk, I thought vexedly. What am I to do? Then I saw something that made me catch my breath, a small scarlet spot on the floor. Using all my strength, I succeeded in dragging the man out into the middle of the cabin. The dead whiteness of his face showed that he had fainted. I found the cause of his fainting easily enough. He'd been stabbed under the left shoulder blade, a nasty, deep wound. I got his coat off and set to work to attend to it. At the sting of the cold water, he stirred, then sat up. "Keep still, please," I said. He was the kind of young man who recovers his faculties very quickly. He pulled himself to his feet and stood there, swaying a little. "Thank you. I don't need anything done for me." His manner was defiant, almost aggressive. Not a word of thanks, of even common gratitude. "That's a nasty wound. You must let me dress it." "You'll do nothing of the kind." He flung the words in my face as though I had been begging a favor of him. My temper, never placid, rose. "I cannot congratulate you upon your manners," I said coldly. "I can at least relieve you of my presence," he started for the door, but reeled as he did so. With an abrupt movement, I pushed him down upon the sofa. "Don't be a fool," I said unceremoniously. "You don't want to go bleeding all over the ship, do you?" He seemed to see the sense of that, for he sat quietly while I bandaged up the wound as best I could. "There," I said, bestowing a pat on my handiwork. "That'll have to do for the present. Are you better tempered now, and do you feel inclined to tell me what it's all about?" "I'm sorry that I can't satisfy your very natural curiosity." "Why not?" I said, chagrined. He smiled nastily. "If you want a thing broadcast, tell a woman. Otherwise, keep your mouth shut." "Don't you think I could keep a secret?" "I don't think. I know." He rose to his feet. "At any rate," I said spitefully, "I shall be able to do a little broadcasting about the events of this evening." "I've no doubt you will, too," he said indifferently. "How dare you?" I cried angrily. We were facing each other, glaring at each other with the ferocity of bitter enemies. For the first time, I took in the details of his appearance, the close-cropped dark head, the lean jaw, the scar on the brown cheek, the curious light gray eyes that looked into mine with a sort of reckless mockery, hard to describe. There was something dangerous about him. "You haven't thanked me yet for saving your life," I said with false sweetness. I hit him there. I saw him flinch distinctly. Intuitively, I knew that he hated above all to be reminded that he owed his life to me. I didn't care. I wanted to hurt him. I had never wanted to hurt anyone so much. "I wish to God you hadn't," he said explosively. "I'd be better dead and out of it." "I'm glad you acknowledge the debt. You can't get out of it. I saved your life, and I'm waiting for you to say thank you." If looks could have killed, I think he would have liked to kill me then. He pushed roughly past me. At the door, he turned back and spoke over his shoulder. "I shall not thank you, not now or at any other time. But I acknowledge the debt. Someday, I'll pay it." He was gone, leaving me with clenched hands and my heart beating like a mill race. Chapter 11. There were no further excitements that night. I had breakfast in bed and got up late the next morning. Mrs. Blair hailed me as I came on deck. "Good morning, gypsy girl. Sit down here by me. You look as though you hadn't slept well." "Why do you call me that?" I asked, as I sat down obediently. "Do you mind? It suits you somehow. I've called you that in my own mind from the beginning. It's the gypsy element in you that makes you so different from anyone else. I decided in my own mind that you and Colonel Race were the only two people on board who wouldn't bore me to death to talk to." "That's funny," I said. "I thought the same about you. Only it's more understandable in your case. You're You're such an exquisitely finished product. Not badly put, said Mrs. Blair, nodding her head. Tell me all about yourself, gypsy girl. Why are you going to South Africa? I told her something about Papa's life work. So, you're Charles Bedingfeld's daughter. I thought you weren't a mere provincial, miss. Are you going to Broken Hill to grub up more skulls? I may, I said cautiously. I've got other plans as well. What a mysterious minx you are. But you do look tired this morning. Didn't you sleep well? I can't keep awake on board a boat. 10 hours sleep for a fool, they say. I could do with 20. She yawned, looking like a sleepy kitten. An idiot of a steward woke me up in the middle of the night to return me that roll of films I dropped yesterday. He did it in the most melodramatic manner, struck his arm through the ventilator and dropped them nearly in the middle of my tummy. I thought it was a bomb for a moment. Here's your colonel, I said, as the tall, soldierly figure of Colonel Race appeared on the deck. He's not my colonel, particularly. In fact, he admires you very much, gypsy girl, so don't run away. I want to tie something round my head. It'll be more comfortable than a hat. I slipped quickly away. For some reason or other, I was uncomfortable with Colonel Race. He was one of the few people who were capable of making me feel shy. I went down to my cabin and began looking for a broad band of ribbon, or a motor veil, with which I could restrain my rebellious locks. Now, I'm a tidy person. I like my things always arranged in a certain way, and I keep them so. I had no sooner opened my drawer than I realized that somebody had been disarranging my things. Everything had been turned over and scattered. I looked in the other drawers in the small hanging cupboard. They told me the same tale. It was as though someone had been making a hurried and ineffectual search for something. I sat down on the edge of the bunk with a grave face. Who had been searching my cabin, and what had they been looking for? Was it the half sheet of paper with scribbled figures and words? I shook my head, dissatisfied. Surely that was past history now. But what else could there be? I wanted to think. The events of last night, though exciting, had not really done anything to elucidate matters. Who was the young man who'd burst into my cabin so abruptly? I had not seen him on board previously, either on deck or in the saloon. Was he one of the ship's company, or was he a passenger? Who had stabbed him? Why had they stabbed him? And why, in the name of goodness, should Cabin 17 figure so prominently? It was all a mystery, but there was no doubt that some very peculiar occurrences were taking place on the Kilmorden Castle. I counted off on my fingers the people on whom it behooved me to keep a watch. Setting aside my visitor of the night before, but promising myself that I would discover him on board before another day had passed, I selected the following persons as worthy of my notice. Number 1, Sir Eustace Pedler. He was the owner of the mill house, and his presence on the Kilmorden Castle seemed something of a coincidence. Number 2, Mr. Paget, the sinister-looking secretary, whose eagerness to obtain Cabin 17 had been so very marked. Nota bene, find out whether he had accompanied Sir Eustace to Cannes. Number 3, the Reverend Edward Chichester. All I had against him was his obstinacy over Cabin 17, and that might be entirely due to his own peculiar temperament. Obstinacy can be an amazing thing. But a little conversation with Mr. Chichester would not come amiss, I decided. Hastily tying a handkerchief round my rebellious locks, I went up on deck again, full of purpose. I was in luck. My quarry was leaning against the rail, drinking beef tea. I went up to him. I hope you've forgiven me over Cabin 17, I said with my best smile. I consider it unchristian to bear a grudge, said Mr. Chichester coldly. But the purser had distinctly promised me that cabin. Pursers are such busy men, aren't they? I said vaguely. I suppose they're bound to forget sometimes. Mr. Chichester did not reply. Is this your first visit to Africa? I inquired, conversationally. To South Africa, yes. But I've worked for the last 2 years amongst the cannibal tribes in the interior of East Africa. How thrilling! Have you had many narrow escapes? Escapes? Of being eaten, I mean. You should not treat sacred subjects with levity, Miss Bedingfeld. I didn't know that cannibalism was a sacred subject, I retorted, stung. As the words left my lips, another idea struck me. If Mr. Chichester had indeed spent the last 2 years in the interior of Africa, how was it that he was not more sunburnt? His skin was as pink and white as a baby's. Surely there was something fishy about that. Yet his manner and voice were so absolutely it. Too much so, perhaps. Was he, or was he not, just a little like a stage clergyman? I cast my mind back to the curates I had known at Little Hampsley. Some of them I'd liked, some of them I'd not. But certainly none of them had been quite like Mr. Chichester. They had been human. He was a glorified type. I was debating all this when Sir Eustace Pedler passed down the deck. Just as he was abreast of Mr. Chichester, he stooped and picked up a piece of paper which he handed to him, remarking, "You've dropped something." He passed on without stopping, and so probably didn't notice Mr. Chichester's agitation. I did. Whatever it was he'd dropped, its recovery agitated him considerably. He turned a sickly green and crumpled up the sheet of paper into a ball. My suspicions were accentuated 100-fold. He caught my eye and hurried into explanations. A fragment of a sermon I was composing, he said with a sickly smile. Indeed, I rejoined politely. A fragment of a sermon, indeed. No, Mr. Chichester, too weak for words. He soon left me with a muttered excuse. I wished, oh, how I wished, that I had been the one to pick up that paper, and not Sir Eustace Pedler. One thing was clear. Mr. Chichester could not be exempted from my list of suspects. I was inclined to put him top of the three. After lunch, when I came up to the lounge for coffee, I noticed Sir Eustace and Paget sitting with Mrs. Blair and Colonel Race. Mrs. Blair welcomed me with a smile, so I went over and joined them. They were talking about Italy. "But it is misleading," Mrs. Blair insisted. "Acqua calda certainly ought to be cold water, not hot." "You're not a Latin scholar," said Sir Eustace, smiling. "Men are so superior about their Latin," said Mrs. Blair. "But all the same, I notice that when you ask them to translate inscriptions in old churches, they can never do it. They hem and haw and get out of it somehow." "Quite right," said Colonel Race. "I always do." "But I love the Italians," continued Mrs. Blair. "They're so obliging, though even that has its embarrassing side. You ask them the way somewhere, and instead of saying, 'First to the right, second to the left,' or something that one could follow, they pour out a flood of well-meaning directions. And when you look bewildered, they take you kindly by the arm and walk you all the way there." "Is that your experience in Florence, Paget?" said Sir Eustace, turning a smile to his secretary. For some reason, the question seemed to disconcert Mr. Paget. He stammered and flushed. Quite so, yes. Then, with a murmured excuse, he rose and left the table. "I'm beginning to suspect Guy Paget of having committed some dark deed in Florence," remarked Sir Eustace, gazing after his secretary's retreating figure. "Whenever Florence or Italy is mentioned, he changes the subject, or bolts precipitately." "Perhaps he murdered someone there," said Mrs. Blair, hopefully. I hope I'm not hurting your feelings, Sir Eustace, but he does look as though he might murder someone." "Yes, pure Cinquecento. It amuses me sometimes, especially when one knows as well as I do how essentially law-abiding and respectable the poor fellow really is." "He's been with you some time, hasn't he, Sir Eustace?" said Colonel Race. 6 years, said Sir Eustace, with a deep sigh. "He must be quite invaluable to you," said Mrs. Blair. "Oh, invaluable. Yes, quite invaluable." The poor man sounded even more depressed, as though the invaluableness of Mr. Paget was a secret grief to him. Then he added more briskly, "But his face should really inspire you with confidence, my dear lady. No self-respecting murderer would ever consent to look like one. Crippen, now, I believe, was one of the pleasantest fellows imaginable." "He was caught on a liner, wasn't he?" murmured Mrs. Blair. There was a slight rattle behind us. I turned quickly. Mr. Chichester had dropped his coffee cup. Our party soon broke up. Mrs. Blair went below to sleep, and I went on deck. Colonel Race followed me. "You're very elusive, Miss Bedingfeld. I looked for you everywhere last night at the dance." "I went to bed early," I explained. "Are you going to run away tonight, too, or are you going to dance with me?" "I shall be very pleased to dance with you," I murmured shyly. "But Mrs. Blair..." "Our friend Mrs. Blair doesn't care for dancing."
"And you do?"
"I care for dancing with you."
"Oh,"
I said nervously. I was a little afraid of Colonel Race. Nevertheless, I was enjoying myself. This was better than discussing fossilized skulls with stuffy old professors. Colonel Race was really just my ideal of a stern, silent Rhodesian. Possibly I might marry him. I hadn't been asked, it's true, but as the Boy Scouts say, be prepared. And all women, without in the least meaning it, consider every man they meet as a possible husband for themselves, or for their best friend. I danced several times with him that evening. He danced well. When the dancing was over and I was thinking of going to bed, he suggested a turn round the deck. We walked round three times and finally subsided into two deck chairs. There was nobody else in sight. We made desultory conversation for some time. "Do you know, Miss Bedingfeld, I think that I once met your father. A very interesting man. On his own subject, and it's a subject that has a special fascination for me. In my humble way, I've done a bit in that line myself. Why, when I was in the Dordogne region..." Our talk became technical. Colonel Race's boast was not an idle one. He knew a great deal. At the same time, he made one or two curious mistakes. Slips of the tongue, I might almost have thought. But he was quick to take his cue from me and to cover them up. Once he spoke of the Mousterian period as succeeding the Aurignacian, an absurd mistake for one who knew anything of the subject. It was 12 o'clock when I went to my cabin. I was still puzzling over those queer discrepancies. Was it possible that he had got the whole subject up for the occasion? That really he knew nothing of archaeology? I shook my head, vaguely dissatisfied with that solution. Just as I was dropping off to sleep, I sat up with a sudden start, as another idea flashed into my head. Had he been pumping me? Were those slight inaccuracies just tests to see whether I really knew what I was talking about? In other words, he suspected me of not being genuinely Anne Bedingfeld. Why?